Cinecast is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/cinecast. And also by Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. Check it out at fit.honda.com. From Chicago, this is Cinecast. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Settle in. It's the 100th episode of Cinecast. Coming up on the show, Massacre Theater, our top 5 or 20 screen performances with special guests Dylan Kidd and Scott Ferguson, plus a pair of exclusive acoustic tracks from Aberdeen City and much more. But first, J.J. Abrams, the first two Mission Impossible movies made a ton of money despite making almost no sense whatsoever. Your mission? Do what Brian De Palma and John Woo did, but better, please. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
And you're going to tell us everything. Every buyer you've worked with, every organization.
What the hell is your name?
Names, contacts, inventory lists.
You have a wife, girlfriend?
It's up to you how this goes.
Because you know what I'm going to do next? I'm going to find her. Whoever she is, I'm going to find her and I'm going to hurt her.
Everyone has pressure points, Barnes. You find something that's personally important to someone and you squeeze. That's a line from the first Mission Impossible movie back in 1996. CIA boss Kittredge tries to flush out renegade agent Ethan Hunt by having his mother and uncle arrested on trumped-up drug charges. Like most of Mission Impossible's labyrinthine plot, I can't recall exactly how Kittredge's plan played out, but I'm pretty sure Ethan's reaction to his family being arrested didn't come anywhere close to the temper tantrum he throws in response to the threat made by Philip Seymour Hoffman in the scene you just heard from Mission Impossible 3. Mom, it seems, can take care of herself, but you do not mess with Ethan's woman, even if protecting her means stealing and turning over the MacGuffin, I mean mysterious device, known as the Rabbit's Foot, to Hoffman's uber-villain, Owen Davian. Taking over for visual maestros Brian De Palma and John Woo, MI3 director J.J. Abrams has said that he wanted to explore new parts of Ethan's character. How do you reconcile being a man who does what Ethan does? Abrams wonders. The old Ethan, stoic, seemingly invincible, and intensely focused on the mission, is out. The new Ethan is a fun-loving, emotionally volatile everyman who just wants to barbecue in his backyard and live the good life with his fiancée, Julia. Sam, there are a number of obvious places to start. I could ask you how the latest entry stacks up against the previous Mission Impossible installments, or whether Abrams' focus on character and emotion pays off, or if it merely distracts from the action. But instead, with this being our 100th episode, I thought I'd get nostalgic for a moment. One of your ideas when we started Cinecast was to begin every review by mentioning something we liked about the movie in question, even if we hated the movie as a whole. We've since abandoned this setup method, but it's there in our first few episodes, and it rears itself again in Cinecast number 18, in which I ask you to explain what you liked about Batman Begins. We didn't know it at the time we recorded the show, but episode number 18 would also mark a milestone for us as it corresponded with the release of iTunes 4.9. For the majority of our audience, Cinecast number 18 was essentially Cinecast number 1. Now, 82 shows later, I'm curious what you liked about Mission Impossible 3.
I'm going to hurt her, and then I'm going to kill you right in front of her. I've said that probably 40 or 50 times since I saw the preview.
Uh-huh.
What did I like about this film? I liked a whole lot, actually, about this movie. Philip Seymour Hoffman only really one of the elements. I think he may actually set a new bar for film villainy,
yeah,
in terms of action film villainy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll get a chance to probably go back and revise our top 5 villains list. Philip Seymour Hoffman as Owen Davian is certainly qualifies.
Uh-huh.
He's just incredible in this. And there are a number of things, I'm sure we'll get to it, about what make his performance so effective in this film. But the rest of the film is so good, too. I mean, it's just got this great supporting cast that's really well employed, I think. Great villain, like I said. Strong, coherent story with really high emotional stakes that we as an audience member can totally relate to. There's lots of well-staged action scenes. He's got a good sense. J.J. Abrams has a really good sense of humor, I think,
mm-hmm,
and employs it well. It's not, you know, saturated with the sort of, like, witticisms. I think he's genuinely interested in all his characters and how they communicate with each other. And I like the sense of physical gravity some directors of action movies ignore. It's like, these are just men, and they have to play by the same rules, even if they are, super secret agents.
Mm-hmm.
They still are at risk of harm. And J.J. Abrams never lets us forget that. I have to say, there wasn't a film like this and that fits into this genre last year that was nearly as good.
Yeah.
And I include, yes, my favorite Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I, this is a, this, if one more film is as good as Mission Impossible 3 this summer, then we will have a, this summer will be a great, great achievement. This is a great summer for movies. I'm genuinely excited. This is the kind of movie that's like sets off the summer on a really strong foot. But what I, and so, yeah, I liked a whole lot about it.
Yeah.
But I think what I really liked was, yes, he invests us very heavily in the stakes. I love how he opens the movie. I really do, because I think it's kind of brave, because it's a film. It's a, it's the scene we've actually seen from the previews.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we've got Philip Seymour Hoffman threatening Tom Cruise's character, Ethan Hunt, and we've seen it already. And we, you know, once we get through the scene, we were wondering, like, well, what's going on exactly? And of course, we realize what he's done is sort of given us sort of an, the end in some way first. And I think that's really effective. But what it also does is give us the emotional stakes. I mean, I think Tom Cruise spends just about half this movie with tears in his eyes.
That's true.
And you know, and it's like, say what you want about it, but it's true. And it, like, he gives, J.J. Abrams really gives a sense of the relationship. I mean, yes, Michelle Moynihan is largely used as a plot device, but I think he gives as much credit, you know, he gives that relationship enough due for it to matter to us, even if that's, yes, that's what it is. We need to take that ride with Ethan Hunt, but it really works.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to hear you say the same, because I really liked it as well, and you are a person who didn't like either of the previous two Mission Impossible films, and I was sort of with the De Palma one. I thought it was okay. I didn't care for the John Woo Mission Impossible 2 at all, the remake of Notorious, as we know. I wasn't really into that. And this one is so much better than the other two films. And something you say is dead on, the thing about the stakes of the film and the fact that the people, while being somewhat heroic and superheroes on some level, there is a sense of there being some stakes and that they are real men. And that's something that did bug me a lot about both of the previous Mission Impossibles and especially the first one with De Palma. I can only suspend my disbelief so much, you know, and I think of a movie like a Bond movie. I remember watching Goldeneye in a crowded theater with a bunch of friends who were excited to see this James Bond film. And the opening scene is this stunt scene where he jumps off a cliff after an airplane that has a propeller plane that's just gone off the cliff. And he doesn't have a parachute on, if I recall. And he jumps off and manages to sort of almost fly, you know, fall with direction right into the cockpit of the plane and pull it up before it crashes. And I know, kind of criticizing a Bond film for ridiculousness, some people would just say, what are you doing? It's a Bond film. But, you know, there's ridiculousness and then there's just total absurdity that takes you out of the moment completely. Yeah. And there's moments like that in Mission Impossible, the original and the second one, where, you know, where he's getting blown off something and he's landing because of an explosion on the back of a moving train. It's just, it's not fun. You know, the special effects are great, but really it's not fun to watch.
To it.
No, you can't. You don't really get into watching it at all. It just seems so fake, like a cartoon.
Yeah.
And here, I really liked almost all of the action scenes in this film. I think they maybe dropped the ball a little bit with the rabbit's foot scene where he has to steal this rabbit's foot, and they actually just, this whole device is a MacGuffin, and they actually turn even the acquisition of it into a MacGuffin in some way, where they don't show you. He's just like, he goes into the building.
Yeah, right, exactly.
He
comes back out with it. Yeah.
But by that point, could you have imagined another set piece? They'd already given you like three big action sequences. I was like, are we really going to go through another one? So I kind of understand it. But I do have to say that despite all the focus on character and emotion, maybe because of it, it was actually the action scenes that really made me appreciate the movie. And, you know, like I said, maybe because you have the character to base it around, but you take the rescuing scene of Carrie Russell early in the film. He goes, this is someone he's trained, and he gets brought in to go back and get her. I think she's in Germany. She's been kidnapped by Davian. That's fantastic. You actually believe what they're doing. The way they break down that scene, you actually believe that it's being carried out, and there are stakes to it that you don't know what's going to happen.
And personal stakes for him.
Yeah.
I mean, just something extra that Abrams actually takes the care to.
And you know, later when they kidnap Davian, the meticulous way they go about showing how they do it, it's similar to that scene in Mission Impossible 1, the great set piece of him breaking into the CIA.
Right.
This movie has a couple big scenes like that, and I really thought that the action scenes were really well executed, and that's what kind of, you know, as a popcorn movie, it works, and Abrams does a great job.
I do, and what I really liked about it was how difficult Abrams makes things for Ethan Hunt. Like, for the first half of the movie, like, he's kind of, there's a sense of him failing in some way and having to make up for it. And there's just a, I really loved the fact that, I think I feel like it's come up a little bit, where it's like, our hero sometimes doesn't have an adversary that's mm-hmm. you know, deserving of him. This absolutely is. And sometimes it's what he's, you know, his own failure is what he's up against in some sense, or his vulnerability all of a sudden. And they just deal with that so well. And I love that. I love the sense of failure that permeates the first half and that he has to overcome that. And the dressing down that Lawrence Fishburne gives Billy Crudup and Tom Cruise is just, it's like, there's so much good about this, and it's like the language, the power of the language that Abrams and his writers have given his actors as well. Yes, he has this great stable of great supporting actors, and he uses them.
Right.
He uses them really well. And so that was really exciting, too. And you mentioned Carrie Russell. This is somebody I'm only aware of in a way of like a pop culture, you know,
Felicity.
And, you know, yes, we saw her in The Upside of Anger, which, uh-huh. you know, we both agreed was pretty much a waste. She's really fantastic in this, and she's only in the film briefly.
For a small part, yeah.
But I was like, I want more Carrie Russell. And, of course, she's actually an Abrams veteran. Of course, Abrams responsible for mm-hmm. Felicity. It was like, even the small roles, I had a huge stake in because I liked them so much. I think Ving Rhames is great, and uh-huh. I love the dialogue that takes place on the downtime.
Yeah.
I mean, that he acknowledges, like, yeah, there's downtime while they're planning these really spectacular, you know, escapes or whatever it is. And it's like, the dialogue he has them sharing is actually, you believe that these people that work together would actually share those kind of conversations.
And you mentioned Michelle Monaghan, who you said maybe she's kind of treated as a prop almost in this film. But I really think she gives a very good, believable performance here.
Everybody
does.
Yeah.
I think she's actually a very good actress because mm-hmm. I saw her. You haven't seen the film yet, but I saw her.
Stealth.
No, not Stealth. Earlier in the year in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang with Robert Downey Jr. And I actually think she's better in that film than Robert Downey Jr. I think she's that good. She really carries that film. She's better than Robert Downey Jr. She's better than Val Kilmer. It's worth seeing to watch her. I think she's a really talented actress beyond just being a pretty face, and I think she does a great job here. And I even like, you know, you didn't like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers in Match Point. I thought he was very good.
He's fine. He's
I like
fun
him
in this,
here
yeah.
along with Maggie Q. I thought they were great
Maggie
in
Q's
supporting
great
roles. Yeah. And then the one big issue with the film, I think you'd agree, Sam, mm-hmm. despite the fact that we did obviously like it, is Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think, is largely wasted.
Oh, he's just, there's not enough of him.
There's just not enough of him because he does take, you said, villainy to a new level. And I think he could maybe if he was given more to do.
Yeah, that's,
but even what he has, though, there's a sense watching it. This is the thing you got to love about Philip Seymour Hoffman. I was thinking that I was almost watching if Brando was playing a villain like this, like your stock action villain.
Yeah.
There's this sort of psychological scarring, you know, and realism that he brings. That scene that you quote, that's so quotable and so fun to say because you've just never heard a villain say anything like that. You're used to getting these villains who are kind of these icy, they're always in control, it seems, of what they're doing.
Right.
He's as volatile emotionally as Tom Cruise is. Right. He takes this all very personally. And you always hear villains talk about, oh, it's just business, I'm just, you know, whatever. He takes it very personally, and again, just that psychological kind of heaviness he brings to it, just like a Brando, you're watching A Streetcar Named Desire or something. Yeah. That's what you feel like you're getting here, and unfortunately, he doesn't have enough to do.
It's true, but there's something really powerful about what he does with what he's given. You know, the scene where he has this very, very spectacular escape, you know, on this bridge over Chesapeake, and I want to follow up that because I think Abrams does a nice job with that too.
Yeah.
But his escape, I mean, it's just like this spectacular thing. And he's being carted away in a helicopter. What does he do when you'd expect him to, like, laugh maniacally at Ethan Hunt below or, like, grin? You know, he just looks away.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful. It's completely punishing. And it's just, it's an amazing, like, just detail of his performances. And I think Abrams allows him to have it. The other thing I loved about that scene that we get, this really just, again, it's a huge, huge set piece. And I was taken out of it just briefly because I'm like, this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. It's like the middle of the day. Traffic is, you know, crowded. You know, there's missiles being fired at a bridge and destroying everything. And I'm like, this is the kind of thing where they never show, like, news coverage. You know, you never get a sense that this is happening in the real world. What does Abrams do, like, 30 seconds after that? Cuts briefly to, like, just a shot of a tiny, like, TV and, you know, and somebody on the news saying, like, you know, it was a big accident on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge today. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, that's all he does. He just acknowledges that somebody in the audience might be thinking that. And I just loved that.
Yeah, there's an attention to detail there that's really fantastic. So I think we're in agreement on this film. Yeah. I think, were there any flaws for you with the film?
I mean, honestly,
other than
Philip Seymour Hoffman, I mean, really,
not getting enough to do.
And I don't want to, like, pick at something I honestly had a genuine experience, a really fun movie-going experience for. But the only thing that I ended up thinking was, like, what is Tom Cruise contributing to this? You know, what is Tom Cruise? Tom Cruise is largely a very charismatic boy and has been. Like, that's his, he's got this sort of reckless, that's his reputation as a character in film.
Yeah.
Like, he's not really, he's a decent actor. I'm not finding a flaw with his acting, but I'm like, I wonder how well he'll age doing these kind of roles compared to somebody like a Harrison Ford. That's what I was thinking, where Harrison Ford, even though Harrison Ford hasn't done anything really interesting recently, you buy him as an older action star. Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise is forever, and he can pull off being like what he was in his mid-20s, late 20s, but once he gets, starts, I was wondering, like, I've wondered for the first time if somebody else really could have maybe done what he does better or show more charm. I mean, the movie is a lot about him showing a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
And we don't get as much of that sort of cocky charm that Tom Cruise usually gives.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought his performance
was
interesting here. It's just like watching Tom Cruise in anything, really. And at first you're put off just by, you talked about this, the jarring way the film opens. It is startling to see Ethan Hunt in peril, not be in control of a situation. And so to see that kind of, this new Ethan Hunt, who all of a sudden isn't all business, but he actually, you know, he's going to the convenience store to get ice and these weird kind of things like that. It takes you a while to get into it. I think he does a fine job. It's hard for me to rip on Tom Cruise because of the fact that I like a decent number of movies that he's in.
Yeah,
you know, on the whole, he's a pretty good action star. And that is an interesting question, though. I mean, Tom Cruise is obviously a guy who's never going to play King Lear.
Right.
So at what point, what is going to happen to
his
performance
as he gets older? Try to think of a part where he's played somebody with gravitas, like that was a parent in some way. You know, even in War of the Worlds, it was difficult to buy him as a parent. What about the fantasy, though? There was this weird fantasy of having, there's a scene in the film, and this isn't really ruining anything, where we actually have Philip Seymour Hoffman playing both the villain and Tom Cruise. I'm like, can we have a movie where Philip Seymour Hoffman plays every single part? Oh. Because it was like a dream come true
that. It really was good, and you're right. I think because we liked it so much, it's probably not fair to get in and nitpick it, but there are a few moments that are those kind of stock action scenes that make you go, wait a second, that is kind of ridiculous, but they're not in the bigger scenes, and you're able to overlook them because of the other things you really like about it. So I will say just one other point I want to make. Unfortunately, I do think he drops the ball a little bit with Philip Seymour Hoffman, because like in that great scene in the cargo plane, the one we played at the beginning of this review, unfortunately, I think, though on the whole, I like what he does with the camera here. There's a real grace to it where the camera is always moving, but it's not in that kind of John Woo or Brian
De
Palma.
It's just like moving like with
it's not drawing attention to itself.
That's
it
true.
Just feels really, you know, it builds a good sense of urgency and it feels like, you know, a big action movie and it works really well. But in that scene with Hoffman and Cruise, the standoff there on the cargo plane, he kind of resorts to this MTV kind of editing, quick edits, quick reactions, lots of close-ups. I'm like, if you would just let Philip Seymour Hoffman chew a little scenery, just keep the camera on him, and then let's see how Tom Cruise responds to it, how Ethan responds. Yeah. It would have been better, but anyway.
It's a good point. All right, well, obviously we liked Mission Impossible 3, a kind of surprise in a way.
So,
it was
really,
but it was a nice surprise. And if you've seen Mission Impossible 3 and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at cinecast@cinecastshow.com. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, what do Sin City, Suspiria, and Laura Linney have in common? Find out as we take a look back at 100 episodes of Cinecast. Plus, later in the show, writer-director Dylan Kidd and Brokeback Mountain co-producer Scott Ferguson help Sam and I count down our top 5 screen performances. But first, Sam, we've got a special treat here. We've got a couple of exclusive acoustic tracks from Aberdeen City, a band we play here regularly on Cinecast, a band we're big fans of. They're a Boston-based band, but 3 of the guys in the group are from Chicago originally. And we got to feel very special Tuesday night.
Tuesday night at the Metro.
Like VIPs, Aberdeen City played at the Metro here in Chicago on Tuesday night. We were on the guest list.
Yes, exactly.
And we got to come in and watch an absolutely fantastic set.
Great set. And at the end of the show, listen in at the end of the show if you're interested. We'll tell you where you can maybe find them. They might be passing through your city over the next couple weeks.
Yeah, they're out on the road right now. We'll give you some tour dates. And of course, you can find more about them at aberdeenmusic.com. We'll also maybe get into, they're going to be back in Chicago. Yeah. Maybe we can have a little Cinecast meetup. At the Aberdeen City show on June 8th here in Chicago.
That'll be at Shubas,
We'll get to that, but right now we do want to play a track. This is something they threw together for us. We weren't able to meet with them. Our schedules just didn't work where we could get together with them and record them, but that day before the show, they got together at the house they were staying at here in Chicago and recorded this track. This is Pretty Pet from Aberdeen City.
I've seen shame on many faces. I've seen it on mine.
And I walked out of it wanting to talk to people about Star Wars, which I, you know, I haven't had that feeling forever. So I loved it.
I'm so excited for you.
Welcome back to Cinecast with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and there you heard one of our favorite moments.
I was genuinely so happy for you.
I'm sure you were, Sam, but one of the moments that definitely stuck.
You misread that. It sounded cynical, but...
But it wasn't?
No, no, I was genuinely so happy
right.
that you discovered your inner 12-year-old.
I'm sorry, you're not convincing me, but when I look back at our 99 episodes and I think about the moments that jump out for me, that's one of them. The Sam Hallgren dismissals, and that was my favorite one. Just making me feel stupid, just with a quick little quip.
And now you can't even look back on that film with any pleasure.
It's true.
That's true.
You ruined it for me.
All right. Well, back on Cinecast number 71, Adam and I recommended Terrence Malick's new film, The New World, which PureFlix is sending to new PureFlix user and Cinecast listener, David Dominic from Ferndale, Michigan. Congratulations, David. PureFlix is a new way to get DVDs cheap. It's only 99 cents every time you get a DVD in the mail. There are no monthly fees, and over 200,000 DVDs are available on the network. Learn more at cinecastshow.com or at peerflix.com/cinecast and receive a free DVD when you sign up. And sign up between now and Monday, May 22nd, and you'll be entered to win Napoleon Dynamite Special Edition out on DVD this week, along with the producers, Matthew Broderick and
Nathan Lane.
Unrated extended editions of Con Air and Enemy of the State and Crimson Tide unrated.
I know you are so excited about this, Sam. Ooh. You can finally get your Tony Scott.
Oh, finally,
fix.
At last. I've been waiting for the unrated editions for these films, apparently. I don't understand.
The world needs the unrated editions.
Have you seen this? I don't know. I mean, this is a bit of an aside, but have you seen these advertisements for Boondock Saints?
I have not.
Special DVD, two-disc DVD unrated edition. I mean, this is like a footnote movie. Is this a cult movie?
I'm
not aware of it.
It's a cult movie. It is. It is actually a cult movie.
Good for... It. I haven't seen it.
I haven't either.
All right.
You're right. It is a cult film. So one quick note before we get into our thank yous here. I just wanted to mention about the song you heard again, Aberdeen City, that acoustic track. We're actually going to make it available along with the next song we're going to play on our website, cinecastshow.com. So you can download it there by going to cinecastshow.com and clicking on the music page. So we want to thank Aberdeen City again. We had a great time at the show talking with Ryan Heller, their guitarist, and one of their guitarists, and just getting to hear an extraordinary set. We look forward to seeing them again. But we also now need to thank, Sam, people who have been so generous as to go to Cinecast Show and donate via the PayPal link.
Yes, thanks so much to Kevin in the End, There Will Be Fire, Tony, Mr. Sweet and 20, Stephanie, Rainbow Bright Unicorn Pony, Stephen, Last Inning Heroics, and to Balthazar, Orange Line to Urien Gato. Tony is a Silver Club member.
He
thanks
is.
So much. He's also a friend of mine. Thanks so much, Tony, Mr. Sweet and 20.
Okay, well, I know some listeners who are very attentive listeners will get the Balthazar reference.
Possibly.
They might remember that story a while back on Cinecast.
Yes.
But also, we should acknowledge that very funny Steph in L.A. She wrote in and she said, I just donated and tell Sam I want a girly nickname.
Hence, and Stephanie Rainbow Bright Unicorn Pony.
I think you nailed it, Sam. Okay, let's get to this week's poll questions. Actually, let's start by looking back. We spent a good deal of time on this on Monday's show, I believe, so we won't get into it too much here. Let's just give the final results. I don't want to gloat here,
no,
Sam.
No, no, you shouldn't.
The poll question, we said in honor of our 100th episode, and again, listeners had recommended this. This wasn't an ego thing for either of us.
No, not at all.
Listeners said you should do it. We thought it would be fun. It wasn't. Don't give me that,
Sam. This
is
the second show we've talked about it, but no, it's true. You're
Let's just give the final number here.
The final numbers. Adam, Mr. Generica, comes in at 44% of Cinecast listeners agreeing with Adam. 40% of you agree with Adam. Split pretty evenly. 33%. Those that agree with me. 18% hardcore members of Club Sam.
Yeah, very vocal. Minority.
Very vocal. Minority, though, yes, let's be clear here. Uh-huh. And rounding up the four, listen despite rarely agreeing, only 6%.
Well, that's good to hear. So that was last week's poll question. This week on CinecastShow.com, you can vote in our current poll with the Da Vinci Code coming out next week. The next movie we'll be reviewing on Cinecast. The question is, we're curious, did you read the Da Vinci Code? The choices, of course, you didn't. No, but I'm excited about the movie. No, and not excited about the movie. And finally, Sam, a great contribution from you. Dan Brown is the Antichrist. Why don't you update where are we at currently?
Yeah, currently with just under 100 votes, we've got at 56% of you, of course, you didn't. A really high number.
Yeah.
Half of those
very literate
answering
audience.
The poll have read the, very literate, have read the Da Vinci Code. At 23% no and not excited about the movie. At 12% Dan Brown is the Antichrist. And coming in at the end here, no but excited about the movie, only 9%.
Where did you vote, Sam?
So I voted, honestly, I can't say I'm really excited about the movie. Despite the cast, despite Ron Howard, who had one of our favorite movies of last year.
Cinderella Man.
Obviously a really competent group, but I can't get excited about the movie. Maybe it's just oversaturation.
Yeah.
I can't really get excited. So
well,
I'm excited about
I voted no as well because I haven't read the book yet. Maybe on my week off next week I'll get to it. We'll
on
see.
The beaches
but
of Mexico.
That's right. But I did say that I'm excited about the movie, and that's just a marginal excitement. I really am kind of with you, but I like Tom Hanks, and I want to see what all the fuss is about, so
all
I guess
right.
I'm marginally
we'll
excited in
keeping
it.
Keeping expectations low for me, so maybe I'll be impressed.
Well, also one note about the show. I mentioned The Da Vinci Code will be the next movie we review, and I mentioned that next week I'm going to be on the beaches
That's
of Mexico taking a break with my family.
You're not going to be able to pass through Uringato, are you?
No, probably
all
not.
Right.
We wanted to then announce that just timing-wise, it couldn't be worse.
For Film Spotting 101.
That's right. Our next episode, we will be Film Spotting, our new name. And again, we want to thank everyone who has sent in feedback so far, overwhelmingly positive. It's great to hear people do seem to like the name. Maybe we just set the bar so low.
I think the people were terrified.
Yeah, they were. A lot of people have said that. So Film Spotting 101, our next show. We're not going to have a show next week. I'm on vacation. And then the following week, Sam, you're on vacation. You're going to be on the road. And what we decided was, it would be better, rather than waiting more than 2 weeks to get another edition of Cinecast, we thought you would at least rather have a guest host than have no episode at all.
And a familiar guest host.
Scott Smith. Who did a fine job. We got a lot of positive feedback.
He's
from Chicagoist.com. He sat in for our Inside Man review and our top five twist endings and did a great job, and we look forward to having him back on. So I'll be on with Scott 2 weeks from now to review The Da Vinci Code. Look for that show on Tuesday, May 23rd. We just wanted to give you a heads up about that. Now the business is done.
Yes.
Let's get into the fun stuff. It's our 100th show.
Yeah.
We wanted to take some time to reflect on what we've done. And we asked several weeks ago, we threw it out there to the Cinecast audience. We said, you know, the 100th episode is going to be coming up. What are some of those moments that stick out for you as your favorite moments? We don't get a chance really to reflect much on the show because we're turning them out two a week, and we just had to keep up with doing them. So we said, hey, can you remind us, what are the moments that you really like? And we got a number of great entries. And as we kind of culled through those, we were able to pinpoint for us the five that we do think, based on what listeners were kind of picking and telling us that they remembered, these are the five moments that we think really stand out. Right, Sam? Not just moments that are really funny, maybe, but have kind of taken on a life of their own.
A bit, yeah.
People still reference them in other emails, you know, as they come to the show.
I think that's fair.
Okay, so with that in mind, Sam, why don't you just briefly set up then? We did a top five here. And again, you can write in and tell us whether or not we've done a terrible job with the rankings, as we usually do.
Yeah.
But let's go ahead here. The number five.
Yeah, number five. This
memorable
is bringing us back to Cinecast number 31, where Adam and I did really a unique top five list, which was our top five overrated movies. Mm-hmm. We almost never do a top five that's sort of a negative top five, and this was definitely an exception. We thought it was worth engaging in, and I think it was. It was probably, at that time, certainly, the top five list generated the most Cinecast response, a lot of it negative to me.
Yeah, and in particular, Sam, your 6 through 10.
My 6 through 10, actually,
was
much
more
provocative
than in your top five was. There was a letdown for the top five because the 6 through 10 annoyed so many people.
And as we'll hear.
As we'll hear in a moment. But let's go ahead and listen to, Sam, a snippet from that show, Cinecast number 31, Sam's 6 through 10 most overrated movies.
I've got the Royal Tenenbaums on my list. I really think that Wes Anderson is batting 500 right now, and he better get his act together. One eccentric is okay with me. One Wes Anderson eccentric is fine with me. 10 or 12 mopey eccentrics, I'm not going there with him.
Okay.
I've got The Usual Suspects on my list.
Wow.
A film I think is so overrated. It's such a generic kind of crime movie.
You're 0 for 3 so far, Sam.
Brutal.
You're
0
for
don't
3.
Understand people's fascination with this movie. Also, and this will tie into my next one. American Beauty. Kevin Spacey, maybe the most overrated actor of the 90s.
Oh, let's not get crazy.
All we do is see the Kevin Spacey character. He's very smirky, and we all know about this. I just don't see him. He performs emotions. He doesn't actually act them.
Wow.
American Beauty, I think, is just easy cynicism, no real heart, and doesn't say anything interesting about certainly the suburbs. And it's sort of like bravura filmmaking, making up for a really lame script.
Okay. Strong words there, Sam, in your overrated list.
Let's not get crazy. I think we did get maybe a little crazy.
Maybe. You were getting carried away.
What's that scene from Batman? Uh-huh. You want to get crazy? Let's get crazy. Let's talk about how much we hate Usual Suspects and American Beauty.
Yeah, two
and
movies.
Fight Club.
And Fight Club was on there. Exactly. Movies that our audience loves. Sam absolutely tore down in that show, and we did get a lot
say,
of
I've really,
interesting
actually
mail.
A whole new group of people I've probably managed to piss off, those people that weren't with us at Cinecast 31 and
exactly.
haven't got back to listen to it.
It's probably true. All right, well, then we get on to number four, and what's funny about this top five list, Sam, is I did notice that if anything happens to you, there's basically no Cinecast.
Yeah, there would be no memorable moments.
Because the top five memorable moments.
The conversation may be much more intelligent, coherent.
I don't know about that, but certainly the humor would be gone. The stuff that people truly remember would be gone if it wasn't for you. So I'll definitely keep that in mind going forward, not to piss you off and lose my bread and butter guy.
As much as you are always promising that you're going to replace me any moment, I'm on the edge of my
seat. That's right, with one of our listeners.
Right.
Let's do this number four then, Sam. This is you. This is during our
Living
discussion.
Living out of fantasy.
Yeah, we did our So Bad They're Good, and this is going to come up again in a little bit too. But we did our top five So Bad They're Good movies back on Cinecast number 61. And you mentioned that this isn't a category for you that really you get into. If a movie's bad, then it's not good.
Bad.
And
it's
you don't
bad, yeah.
really enjoy watching it. But the one exception,
this was an exception.
Might be Al Pacino in The
Devil's
Advocate. And so you had an opportunity to finally let Al out. Here it is.
He sets the rules in opposition. It's the goof of all time. Look but don't touch. Touch but don't taste. Taste but don't swallow. Ha ha. Why are you jumping from one foot to the next? What's he doing? He's laughing his sick fucking ass off. He's a tight ass. He's a sadist. He's an absentee landlord. So I mean you got Al Pacino as the devil and me doing my Al Pacino as devil impersonation. I mean, this was the highlight of Al Pacino really hamming it up in late night. That was the peak. That was a true
just
peak.
Totally over the top. And Sam,
wow,
I thought
what
you
a fan.
Channeled
I mean,
him
it, now,
well.
I mean, that was, I got that out of my system, and now I've gotten the, I'm going to hurt her. And I just can't stop
can't
doing
stop
that.
It.
I love it. And I'm going to kill you. All right, but I'm done. I mean, but if Cinecast offers a, you know, not infrequent opportunities with Massacre Theater and other times to really just do what we all love to do.
Which is pretend.
Pretend.
Right?
Play That's
pretend.
Right. That's
so,
right.
Okay, well, number three then, Sam, on the list.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't get a chance to read some of these emails on the air, but a number of people during our American Dreams discussion, for example, wrote in and said, best review ever, because even though I don't care at all about this
royale
movie,
like that.
It's fun to hear you guys argue. And for our first four episodes of Cinecast, I think we gave the same star rating. We were basically agreeing with each other on the movies we reviewed. We didn't like Be Cool. We didn't really like Millions. We didn't like The Ring.
Yeah.
We both kind of liked Melinda and Melinda.
Right.
Then we got to Sin City. The movie that I really loved and thought for sure you would too, but Sam, that would not be the case.
It made me deeply uncomfortable. I felt like I was unfortunately privy to Frank Miller's deepest, darkest secrets and diaries that I felt like this is a man who hates women. I mean, I've never seen such I can't remember the last time I've seen something.
But wait a second.
Exploitative.
I mean, first of all, You know why? Because they're all wearing these scantily clad, and they're all, you know, busty women and whatever, and attractive, and they're kind of getting slapped around a little bit. I see where you're coming.
Yes.
But, okay. Oh, that's it.
That's it. I guess.
But
yeah.
Listen.
All right.
And that's it, Sam. I mean, why don't I just try to defend
myself? I don't know.
It's
almost as if I should have just let you hang yourself. Yeah. I mean, I guess you were just sort of defining misogyny for me, and all I had to do was say, yes, well, yes, that's exactly what I did.
I'm going to defend myself by making your case.
Oh, it's nice to know things haven't changed.
So that was fun. Sin City, definitely a popular
chapter
review.
One of the Cinecast, fan book. I think will be chapter one, Sin City. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where it will begin. That's really where Cinecast began.
Well, because the previous movies we'd reviewed weren't all that big. No one really cared about those films.
No, there was no stakes, yeah.
Yeah, really care about them. Then Sin City was one that people were really looking forward to, obviously.
Yeah, we both were movie buffs
out there would be into a movie like that. And you got Frank Miller and Robert Rodriguez doing this kind of new innovative technology.
Wow.
And then we had a good rumble.
We had it out.
Yeah, we even had it out in Cinecast number 6 during the listener feedback section.
That was
fun as well. So that is number 3 on the list. And the battles just don't stop. We then get to our number 2, and this goes back to our horror marathon.
Yeah.
We reviewed Dario Argento's Suspiria. And when we got emails from you, this came up a lot as one of the great battles. Certainly, a ton of email, people probably pretty evenly defending me and defending you. Here's a snippet.
Back on Cinecast number 57.
That's right. Here's Cinecast number 57, our discussion of Suspiria.
I don't want to even assign it a place. This movie is comically bad.
Oh, my God.
It is. At a certain point, what's the
name
of the actress again?
You're really going to do this.
Well, what's the name of the
actress? You're going to tear apart Argento.
What is Banyan's name?
Jessica Harper, Susie.
Jessica Harper. I was getting the indication that Ms. Harper was like terrified because she was like, what the hell kind of movie have I gotten myself into? How do I get out of this movie? How do I get out of this coven of witches, a dance academy, and how do I get out of this movie? I was like, well, maybe it was written by an 11-year-old with a vivid imagination.
Don't you hear me, Sam? You're losing us subscribers.
What a calm sort of contempt I seem to have
with
that film. My God, but that was, I mean, if anyone's been willing to stand behind a microphone and blaspheme openly to people that, you know, to a group of people that may hold a film like this very dearly.
Yeah.
It's me. That's called bravery.
You are really taking shots at some sacred cows, which is not your goal necessarily.
No, it's not at all. This is not my role. No.
And I have to say, I mean, going back and listening to that, even though I disagree with you, even though I was trying to defend Suspiria there, I have to say, just hearing you say that it was comically bad and then suggesting that maybe the Argento film was written by an 11-year-old.
I Googled that. I was trying to find out if maybe he had his 11-year-old daughter pen that, or at least a first draft.
So you really, really thought that was the case. Oh, my God.
I thought I maybe heard that in the director's commentary. I don't know.
That's Suspiria. So that definitely came in a lot from you guys, and we agree, is sort of a memorable, definitely a memorable moment on Cinecast from number 57. And we get then, Sam, to number 1. We're counting down the top 5 memorable moments, and this is the one that came up the most, without a doubt. Really, it's such a small moment, and yet it's a moment where, Sam, you again have added to the lexicon. You have given the world something that people are out there using. They're throwing it around.
I feel bad.
I know you do.
Because it's only going to be used for evil, not for good.
I know. But that's you, Sam. You're a nice guy, but you're really evil.
Of evil.
Clearly, from what we're hearing in these top 5 moments. And this is another one of them, a classic moment. You know it's coming. Here it is.
The big hole in this is
Laura Linney.
Yes, it is Laura Linney. She is just, I feel like you have an opportunity here. I mean, Jeff Daniels, you know who he is the moment he walks on the screen. Mm-hmm. Laura Linney is an age-appropriate character delivery device, and that's all she is. I'm sorry, Laura.
I'm sure you are, Sam.
I don't know what to say.
The beauty of that, too, going back and listening to it, is I remember that so well. People keep bringing it up, the age-appropriate character delivery device, and it is so funny. And yet, when you go back and listen to it, Sam, it really sounds completely like you didn't have that written in your notes. Did you have that in your notes?
No, I had, I mean, in a way, like when I had, I think at the time, like in the context, like I was describing, like that Carrie and I had been having a conversation about it. We were trying to, as we sometimes like to do, recast the movie. I was like, who else could have played it? And then I realized, well, the only reason Laura Linney was playing that role was because she was the only person actually the age-appropriate person.
And from there, you got the AACDD, the age-appropriate.
I don't know how often it's being applied out there
delivery device
to other actors. And
well, for Laura Linney's sake, let's hope there aren't any casting agents that are
possibly,
you know,
right.
Or then
well, maybe
again,
they
maybe
are,
that's
because
what
if they
want.
Need an age-appropriate character delivery device, the only person that's actually been given that stamp of approval
it's their
is
go-to
Laura
gal.
Linney.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, but again, you're sorry,
you're
right?
You're welcome, Laura. I don't know. I'm not sure now.
Okay, maybe you are helping her career somehow. Well, those were the top five moments, again, that came in from you, and then our own recollection of those moments. We remember them fondly as well. We wanted to close out this segment by just sharing a few emails, because again, when we really thought about the most memorable stuff for us, as I said, we don't get to really reflect on a lot of these moments as they're happening. And we think of what really makes this show so worth it to do is the feedback
that we get from you guys,
from you, without a doubt. And hearing about the people that are enjoying the show and what they're getting out of it and from where all over the world. And some
just
of those really
amazing,
crazy stories of people having Cinecast moments where they meet someone else. And this is one we shared on the air at the time. Pat Miner in Fort Lewis, Washington wrote in and mentioned that he was on an airplane sitting next to someone. They both have to shut their iPods off. They get into a discussion of what they're into. They're both into podcasting. And he asks what he was listening to at that moment. And he says it's a podcast about movies hosted by two guys from Chicago called, and there's
Cinecast,
a pause, and Cinecast, they both say together. That was crazy because this was in Sacramento, it looks like. They're at an airport, two guys randomly seated next to each other listening to Cinecast. And one we didn't read on air, Sam, is this a great one we got a couple months ago, I think, from Edward.
Possibly more incredible, if that's possible, in terms of coincidence. Edward Platero wrote in, he has a daily commute from London, Ontario to Windsor, Ontario. It's about a two-hour drive. He'd stopped to pump some gas. I had noticed the gentleman pumping gas in front of me started to look at me very intent on trying to hear what the noise was coming from my car. I shut off the car and started pumping my gas. Right then, he walked up to me and said, "Excuse me, if you don't mind me asking, were you just listening to Cinecast?" I laughed and said, "Yes, I take it you're a listener too. We talked for a couple of minutes about the show. It seems he just got finished listening to Friday's show, not 5 minutes before. We also talked about our locations. I'm from London, Ontario, Canada, and he resides in Royal Oak, Michigan. So, in that instant, Cinecast created an international bond between two countries. You guys should be proud." And that's Edward Platero in London, Ontario,
and
Canada.
We are proud. I mean, that's what
proud,
we set out to do, Sam, right?
Just awestruck, honestly.
Yeah.
We know there aren't maybe a million listeners out there, but just the fact that there are enough for those coincidences to take place, just amazing. And thank you, everyone that's written in. My God, I think we keep all of the emails we've ever written. It's nearing 11,000 emails. And just knowing the sheer volume of emails that we've received.
Well, and I think, you know, we mark them. We use Gmail, and we mark them with a label when we get them so we can go back and refer to them, what the subject matter is. And I think we have one of them that's called Love the Show, which kind of houses these people just writing in saying how much they like the show or these kind of bizarre coincidences. And I think it was almost at 2,000 or something. We were trying to go
just
through
amazing.
These, and it was like, how are we going to get through these today? So we're leaving out a ton that are probably equally as good as Edward's, but a couple of these, like Edward's and Pat's, really stick out. And we wanted to just mention a few others here that are really kind of fun, in that what makes Cinecast so great for us, too, doing it, is not only obviously getting the feedback, but hearing from people who disagree with us, and yet they keep listening because they enjoy the discussion so much. They enjoy the conversation despite disagreeing with us. And a perfect example of that, we mentioned the top five overrated. And we got this email from Ron Harshman in Pittsburgh, who's been a good contributor, has sent in a number of emails throughout the first 99 episodes of Cinecast. And he mentions that he had burned our show onto a CD so he could listen to it on his way home from work. And he says, "I don't have a huge DVD catalog, around 20 films. I, like I believe Adam has mentioned in the past, am very particular about what a DVD needs to have. That being said, I own four of those movies. Four of the movies on your 6 through 10 he owns, and considers three of them, The Royal Tenenbaums, Fight Club, and The Usual Suspects, to maybe be on his personal top five all-time list. Definitely top 10. And he says the only reason he doesn't own The Natural, another movie you ripped on that I love, is because there isn't a worthy DVD edition of it. So he says, anyway, he's listening to that. He gets home a few minutes later and was huffing and puffing, muttering under his breath, and his wife says, 'What's wrong?' I replied, 'You are not going to believe what Sam's list was.' Now, at this time, she had never heard your show and had no idea who Sam was, but as fired up as I was about it, I loved the show even that much more. That is when I knew that each episode was not only going to be entertaining, but also a fun ride." So again, we just, when you get emails like that from a guy who clearly he just couldn't believe, you know, the venom you were spewing from your mouth about films that he loved, and yet that just made him like the show even more.
Well, and I think too, because part of it, like you said, it's not something I'm doing to try to infuriate people.
Right.
It's like I'm speaking genuinely about how I feel about a movie, and it's sincere. It comes from a very sincere place in my dark, dark heart.
It's misguided and wrong, but it's sincere.
right. I hear what you're saying.
You understand, but I'm completely wrong.
I'm completely wrong.
Okay.
But I think too, we realize, I think, like, our, you know, movie watching perspectives have changed since we've been doing this. And I think what's exciting too is when we get an email from somebody whose perspective, a listener's, has changed in a while. We got this email from Taryn writing from Petersburg, Virginia. She wrote about her most memorable Cinecast moment. It went back to Cinecast 20, our World the Worlds review. And she said she saw World of Worlds and liked it a lot and had just started listening to the show. And she writes that she knew we'd hate it and decided not to listen to Cinecast 20. After some time to digest the film, I listened to the show and found that although I did like War of the Worlds, I pretty much agreed with the flaws pointed out. I even recalled moments that I was sitting in the theater and rolled my eyes at the obvious manipulation. That's the moment I knew I was going to love Cinecast. The review made me think about the film, and since then has caused me not to just watch movies, but digest and analyze. Something I guess I was doing anyway, but now I'm much more active. I'm watching different types of films and straying from the new release section of Blockbuster, which is great, and I think it's a rut that I've gotten into in my past, you know, and it's something that I think we've received a lot of emails about. It's just like, if you don't know where to look necessarily, you don't have something specific to look for, it's very easy to get distracted, you know, by the wall of new releases.
It is, and you know, her last line, she says, in short, my film experience has been changed. We've turned her into a pretentious moviegoer.
Right, that's our goal. Yeah,
you know,
right.
I don't know if we're changing everybody's cinema experience.
No,
that was certainly
not
our plan, but even a few people like Taryn, again, she liked War of the Worlds a lot, and she heard us review it, and we both kind of tore the movie apart a little bit, but we also talked about the things we did like about it. And hopefully that must be something, I guess, Sam, we're doing right when we get emails like this from people like Taryn, and that we can, in that they can listen to us talk about a movie and be negative about it, but still enjoy the discussion. So I don't know. Again, I guess that tells us we're doing something okay, and hopefully we'll continue to do that.
And thank you again for everyone that's written over the past 99 shows.
Yeah, without a doubt. If you've got feedback for us too about this or anything else, email us at cinecast@cinecastshow.com. You can also send us a short MP3 clip or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINE. That's 206-203-2463.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, another round of Massacre Theater, including this week's winner and part one of our top five screen performances. To help us get started, we enlisted Scott Ferguson, whose resume boasts such titles as Brokeback Mountain co-producer, second assistant director on Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, unit production manager on the upcoming All the King's Men, and, most importantly, Cinecast listener. Here he is.
Number 5, Natalie Wood in Splendor in the Grass. Number 4, Liza Minnelli in Cabaret. Number 3, Jane Fonda in Clute. Number 2, Shirley MacLaine in The Apartment. And number 1, Julie Christie in Darling.
I've been shaking hands. He's been taking numbers all my life.
In a world, few hearts survive.
All I know is the way I feel. When it's real, I keep it alive. The road is long. There are mountains in your way. We climb a step every day.
Welcome back to Cinecast with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Hallgren. That was Aberdeen City performing In Combat and the true definition of Massacre.
Yeah.
Really up where we belong. Our infamous duet
uh-huh.
Back on Cinecast number 56. from Officer and a Gentleman.
That's right,
of course,
the closing
top
finale.
Five music moments tie-in. Right.
We were doing our top five music moments,
didn't
and we
quite
thought,
get to the chorus.
No,
we
didn't.
Should we do it now?
No.
Oh, you don't
not.
Have your guitar. It's too bad.
No, I don't. Yeah, it's really too bad we're depriving our audience of that. That was awful. I can't believe we actually played it again.
Right.
But again, a moment that definitely
memorable.
Came up in a number of emails could have easily been.
We nearly caused a car accident in one case, reportedly, yeah. from a Cinecast listener.
Laughing so hard at how
laughing,
bad
or just the horror,
our singing was.
The
yeah.
horror. All right. Well, it is time for Massacre Theater. Last week, Adam and I massacred a scene from Neil Jordan's The Crying Game, possibly a tie-in to our top five one-timers, but also a movie connected to United 93, of course, and dealing with the issue of terrorism. Adam, reach into that Cinecast hat. Are we going to call it the film spotting hat?
Oh, I guess so.
Can we still call it the Cinecast hat?
It's
got Cinecast labeled all around it.
I don't know if legally we can, Sam.
Maybe you're right. All right, reach into the Cinecast / film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Scott Larson from Salt Lake City, Utah. Congratulations, Scott. Email Cinecast at cinecastshow.com and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I love seeing those these names that I do recognize
yeah.
time and time.
It is nice when people
frequent
who... Frequent entrance,
yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. Finally Scott. Get a chance to win. It is totally random, and Scott was the winner. So congratulations, Scott. Let's get to this week's Massacre Theater. I don't know what
yes.
we want to say about it,
Sam. I don't either. I don't think we should say
let's at least
anything.
Acknowledge
All right.
that it doesn't tie in with Mission Impossible 3 in any clear way, anyway.
Okay.
That's
sure
not what we were referencing.
That's true.
We're not even trying to reference top five performances,
no,
which we're going to get to.
But it does contain performances.
Yes, it does. So. Yeah, of course. Very good
As
ones,
As you will
too.
See, yes.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they'll see it in our masterwork
well, right.
here, Sam, in this master class we're right. about to teach. But I will say that, of course, it being our 100th episode,
yeah,
we had to pick something that
was appropriate.
Was appropriate.
I think that's
Let's just
no
leave
more
it at that.
Needs to be said.
Okay.
I'm... This and it's appropriate to the part I'm playing, I think.
Okay, yeah, it is appropriate. If you look back on Massacre Theater, it is appropriate. And
right.
this is a tough one, Sam.
This,
are we ready for this?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Big shoes to
I
fill.
I think I start it, so you, of course,
action.
Give me the action.
Yes, and action.
Have you gone completely crazy? Don't you realize that everybody here is going to know about this? That you've packed your bags, ordered the car, and...
And left? Of course they'll hear. I'm not saying goodbye, except to you. But I never imagined that people wouldn't know.
I won't let you go.
You can't stop me. Goodbye.
Don't go.
Let's not start all over again. We've said everything that can be said.
Don't go, please. You mustn't go. Everything will be exactly the way you want it. Not the way I think you want it, but your way. And scene.
Ugh.
That was awful.
That we appropriately awful.
That was truly a
massacre.
A true massacre. And if you know what film we just massacred, send us an email by Monday, May 22nd to cinecast@cinecastshow.com. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on our next show. Before we get to our top five, which I'm very excited to get
yes.
into here, our top five and our guests with Dylan Kidd, we'll talk about Scott's list here in a moment. We do have to announce the winner of our Masters of Horror giveaway. Showtime, of course, as we mentioned, they're doing this Masters of Horror series where filmmakers like Stuart Gordon and John Carpenter, people who were part of our horror marathon, they're turning out these one-hour films. They're showing them on Showtime. Anchor Bay is releasing them on DVD. You can learn more about it at mastersofhorror.net. They were nice enough to provide us with a couple of DVDs, and we said, hey, if you sign up for the Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast, we'll pick a winner out of that group of people who have subscribed at random and announce the winner of the two DVDs. And Sam, in this case, it was Stephen Carson. Stephen Carson is going to win the first two DVDs in the Masters of Horror series, John Carpenter's Cigarette Burns and Stuart Gordon's Dreams in the Witch House.
Nice.
So congratulations, Stephen. Send us an email. Of course, cinecastshow.com. We'll get your vitals, and we will mail those out to you. And also, we have another giveaway. The next two movies in the series, Mick Garris's film Chocolate and Don Coscarelli's Incident on and Off a Mountain Road.
Nice.
A great title there. Coscarelli, we had for a while his movie Phantasm, I
That's
think,
right.
was going to be part
yes.
of our marathon, and then it got left off. But we have those two movies now. If you sign up between now and our next show on Tuesday the 23rd, if you're on that list of Dope Sheet subscribers, you will be entered to win those two movies in the set as well. So
it's fun. That's
yeah,
fun.
It definitely is. We like giving free stuff away
yes,
to our listeners.
Yes.
With that said,
yes.
we are now at
wow.
the big moment, Sam. This really was.
We're about a quarter of the way through the show.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
It's like the Oscars here.
It really is.
This is going to be a marathon. Yeah, it's going to be a marathon show.
Take the long way home.
Exactly. And, you know, you do have a week in between shows.
That's true.
So you've got some extra time. It's not a two-day thing like it normally is between Wednesday and Friday. You've got some time. If you need to do this in installments, we'll understand.
We understand.
But top five performances. And as some listeners wrote in, they said, hey, wait a second. You initially had said you were going to do your top five desert island movies,
right?
Which made sense for your, you know,
but there
for your 100th show.
There are no desert islands,
but that's
so it's
true.
Not actually practical. I found
you're such a practical guy.
I'm very
too,
practical.
Sam. But really, what it was is we kind of just talked about it, and we're like, as we predicted, people started sending in our list, and they pretty
they
much nailed exactly our top five.
Yeah.
I mean, if you listen to the show, you know the movies that always come up in our top fives. You know which movies are Sam's favorite, my favorites, what we're going to bring to a desert island.
And you're still going to get to hear some of those, I'm sure.
Yeah,
in top
you are.
Yeah.
And so we were like, you know, that's just not exciting enough, and we couldn't wrap ourselves around it really. And then when Premiere came out with that list of the 100 greatest performances, which we talked about a month ago on the show, we thought that would be really fun to do, is get into performances. And we were naive enough, Sam, to think we could do just five.
Yeah.
But we hadn't.
We did really hold on to that fantasy for
weeks. We did. And now I can't even fathom if we'd only done five. And it worked out really well. What we said is, okay, our 100th show, we got to get some guests. And who would be better for the show than Dylan Kidd, who people have heard us talk about, Roger Dodger, the writer-director of this movie.
Cinecast's
a movie
favorite.
We love. We just love. If you haven't seen it yet, it is probably more of a guy movie. I've received an email from at least one female Cinecast listener who said, yeah, I didn't really get it. You know, it wasn't into it. But we think you'll love it. You should check it out. And it turns out we had a connection to Dylan Kidd.
We did have a connection to Dylan Kidd. It just so happens Dylan Kidd is co-writing a screenplay with Ira Glass, my boss at This American Life.
Yeah. And so we were able to exploit that connection.
Yes.
You met with him
successfully
a few weeks ago in New York.
That's right.
And sat him down to get his top five performances. And Sam, rather
than us. What did he bring us?
Yes. Rather than us set this up, kind of, you know, we like to set up, here's our criteria for the top five, and here's the format of it, how it's going to go. We're going to go ahead and let Dylan Kidd do it.
Couldn't have done it any better.
No, we couldn't have done it any better. And actually, we had not thought about our list really at all at the time that he came in and sat down and did his list. And then we ended up completely following his cue. So let's go ahead and turn it over to Dylan Kidd, again, writer-director of Roger Dodger. Let him set up the top five, and you'll hear his number five male comedic performance. Here's Dylan Kidd.
Hey, this is Dylan Kidd. I directed a movie called Roger Dodger and a movie called P.S. I've been invited by Sam to give my top five film performances, and of course I could not limit myself to five or 10 or 15 or even 20, so I ended up making a bunch of subcategories. I started out by breaking it into actor and actresses, and then decided I couldn't. That even that wasn't enough, so I ended up with four categories, which is male dramatic, male comedic, female dramatic, female comedic, and these are all, you know, obviously drama and comedy are sort of like arbitrary divisions. But there are a lot of sort of obvious suspects out there, and what I realized is that for me, there's something about the cinema where it's very much about just like pleasure in watching, you know, beautiful people up on a big screen. And so what I tried to do is I tried to pick performances that just give me pleasure. You know, there are great technical actors out there that, you know, you can certainly watch with a lot of, you know, admiration. And the actors and actresses I chose are people that every time I see these movies, even if they're really grim, dramatic movies, like these people's presence on screen just gives me joy. It just makes me smile. Let's see. Let's start with male comedic. Number five for me, and again, these ranks are kind of, you know, arbitrary, but I wanted to like actually be rigorous with myself and try to like actually narrow it down. Number five is Steve Coogan in 24 Hour Party People, which is great. People tell me that Steve was on that show in the UK, the Alan Partridge something or other, and I have a feeling that he's sort of like, this is his shtick, so I don't know how, if you can really call it a performance, but I laughed my ass off and I was actually very moved by it, and I'm a big Michael Winterbottom fan anyway, so I just think Steve Coogan is great.
So Sam, you were actually there with Dylan in the room,
and
right away you had to just start thinking, wow, this is like he could be a host on Cinecast.
Is he reading my mind? I mean, it really was, this is how I've been describing it to people, it was like listening to a hyper articulate version of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just uncanny. The kind of things he's never listened to the show. He's said he's interested in actually listening to it when, you know, this show, when
we
post
hope.
It. We hope, certainly. But yeah, it was really like he was saying exactly the same kind of things.
Yeah, and if you've been listening to the show regularly, you heard things in what he said that just absolutely mimic things we usually talk about. He couldn't limit it to five, so he had to break it down into subcategories, which was a brilliant idea. Now
really
we
was.
Can really get in and explore those.
Because if we're going to do the exact
oh,
same
man,
thing.
If we had had to do just five, it would have been impossible. And the other thing we both loved about what he said, and this really set the tone for our entire list, Sam, was performances that give me pleasure.
Yeah.
This is something we talk about a lot on the show. Some people sometimes take issue with it, but we're not always trying to come up with some kind of objective list, top five list of the best something,
right,
but our favorites.
Yeah, right.
Moments in films or performances that we just absolutely love
despite
watching.
What the content or the subject matter or
yeah,
what's being depicted, it gives you a sense of visceral pleasure. And
mm-hmm,
I think not only did Dylan use this to put his list together, but I mean, this is a theory he has really about film itself, that film itself is really about experiencing pleasure, whatever you're watching in
okay,
some way.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that a little bit more as we go through the list. And you heard, Sam, his number
yeah,
five. Your eyes had to light up when you heard
absolutely,
his number five, male comedic Steve Coogan, 24-hour
Party
People.
I was sitting
not,
you know, 2 feet away from pumping my fist with pleasure, but also bemoaning the fact that I couldn't possibly put it on my list.
I thought
now,
it might make your list.
No, but it probably would have.
Okay, well, let's hear your number five
all right,
then.
So my number five is, and this kind of surprised me, putting things together, when I sort of was putting a pantheon together of comic performances, and this was a lot of fun to put together, was Adam Sandler as Barry Egan in Punch Drunk Love.
Really? Wow.
And I thought of it's really what the film is a perfect match of actor and character and content. And the way that P.T. Anderson uses, I think, perfectly, absolutely perfectly, and yes, it's a film I love, but I really think the performance itself is actually flawless. I mean, just looking quickly at the film again and looking through just the lines, the quotable lines, and every moment. And I think it sets up my list here of comic performances. Every one of these actors and actresses, particularly the actors, bat 1,000. Everything that comes out of their mouth is funny.
There's not a moment that doesn't work.
Yeah,
is what
and
you're
I think
saying,
that's honestly the case with Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love.
I think that's a great choice. I completely overlooked Adam Sandler, and he is brilliant in that role in Punch Drunk Love. My number five is Don Cheadle. And I've got kind of a tie here. I'm using both of his performances in Devil in a Blue Dress, the movie that was his breakout role, and also playing Snoopy Miller in Out of Sight, another Cinecast favorite. And especially, though, you think about his role as Mouse in Devil in a Blue Dress, as Denzel Washington's friend who shows up. And this brilliant line sums up the whole brilliance of the performance. He says, "You said don't shoot him, right? Well, I didn't. I strangled him. If you didn't want me to kill him, why did you leave me alone with him?" And it's true. Like, yeah, he genuinely means when he says that. He's not just being sarcastic, because Denzel Washington, E.Z. Rollins should know his nature better than that. He should know that isn't a good idea if you didn't want him to die. And he's the type of character that's so fun to watch, because he literally stares right at you and can tell you that he understands every word you're saying. And then he's going to go and do whatever he wants in the moment when he reacts right to it. And that's what makes him so fun to watch, that he's just so totally reactionary. And of course, I love him in Out of Sight as well. Just every line he has in Out of Sight cracks me up.
It's a great pick. All right, let's hear Dylan Kidd's number four.
Number four, comedic performance. And again, these are like, you know, it's like this is another movie that sort of blurs the line. But Nicolas Cage in Vampire's Kiss is a performance that I was hugely impressed by when I was in film school. This is a sort of obscure movie from the late 80s, early 90s, I think. And it's a great example of an actor just like making a really gutsy choice and just going for it. It's a totally stylized performance. And regardless of what you think of Nicolas Cage, this is a great, like, over-the-top comedic performance.
So Nicolas Cage in Vampire's Kiss, a film you haven't seen
no
yet, and a film I have seen, and it is, just as he describes, this just larger-than-life performance.
Yeah, no, and I have seen a good portion of it, because I've mentioned this before.
Yeah.
There are some movies that just you've never
just
seen
catch,
from
right,
start to finish,
right,
but you see most of it. You're
right,
flipping channels at night, and you get hooked on it. And you do get glued watching Nicolas Cage in that role. I mean, that's the role, right, where he eats the cockroach.
I
mean,
yeah,
he just, as he said, the gutsy choices that he makes and going, and he, Nicolas Cage, there's nobody better at just going for a role, as Dylan Kidd said. I agree completely
yeah,
with Nicolas Cage appearing on a list
yeah,
like this.
Absolutely.
So let's get to your number four then,
all
Sam.
Right, my number four, an actor that would probably show up maybe on a performances dramatic list, and it's Gene Hackman in two roles that I love him in, supporting roles, Harry Zim in Get Shorty, and Royal Tenenbaum in The Royal Tenenbaums. Not a film I like so much, but I really think truly one of Gene Hackman's greatest performances is in The Royal Tenenbaums as Royal Tenenbaum. And it's a film where these are two different, very different characters, but Harry Zim is almost like the anti-Gene Hackman type. He's just kind of, he's kind of a foolish, he's a producer of these B-movies, he's kind of superficial, kind of clueless, and you know, but he seems to know that character so well, and it's surprising how well he's able to embody it
yeah,
and how easily. And he's also just, I think, absolutely brilliant in The Royal Tenenbaums, where he's just unsympathetic, kind of mean, but remarkably charismatic,
yeah,
of course, as well.
No, both Great choices. I agree with you. My number four, people might hear this, think I'm sucking up somehow. Again, I don't think the Dylan Kid, he may not ever end up hearing this. And again, he recorded his bit before we did ours, but I did have to include Campbell Scott in Roger Dodger. This is a performance where Campbell Scott gets to be the ultimate smartass, and sometimes those guys are just fun to watch. They're so charismatic. He seems so hyper-intelligent, smarter than everybody else in the room, while at the same time, he's so irresponsible and childish, just so immature. And the way he's dead on and tearing people apart is fun to watch, but I think what Campbell Scott does is he just doesn't overplay the humor. There's an extra layer there where you can't quite always figure out and put your finger on whether he's really a bad guy or not. And I think that's really the strength of the performance. So
it's a great pick. All right, well, let's hear Dylan Kidd's number three.
Number three, Woody Harrelson in Kingpin. I love Kingpin. I'm not even a big Farrelly Brothers fan, but I was really moved, strangely, by Kingpin. And I think like there's something really joyous about watching a great actor in a sort of broad comedy and sort of how he negotiates that terrain. Woody Harrelson is just like totally seamless in this movie, and he only has like two or three scenes where he's meant to like, you know, actually like move you. And it's like if you cry in a Farrelly Brothers movie, chances are there's a great performance going on.
I love his line there: if you cry during a Farrelly Brothers
movie,
there's
a good performance contained.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And you have to think about it. This is something he absolutely mentioned true. Back when he talked about Steve Coogan, is being moved even by yes. a comedic performance. I think that's a great point. That's something Dylan Kidd looks for in certain performances. I'll go ahead and give my number three. I kind of gave it away a little bit ago. I mentioned that I can't disagree with Nicolas Cage appearing on this list. Well, of course I can't, because he's my number three. And again, I've got a tie. I've got Raising Arizona and Peggy Sue Got Married, which I don't know if it's come up on the show before or not. This is a movie, a Coppola movie that people always overlook. I'm not sure how many people like it. I genuinely like the movie Peggy Sue Got Married, but the thing that gives me the most pleasure watching it is Cage's performance as Charlie Bodell. His voice, when it cracks, when Peggy dumps him, he gets so emotional that his voice cracks. And I know some people think his voice is annoying. I think it's brilliant, and I love it in that movie. And when it cracks in that scene when he gets emotional, just kills me every time. I mean, makes me laugh, but you feel for him. And the scene where she comes on to him in the car, she gets sexual. It's back in the 50s. It's supposed to be the guy making the move. She's making the moves, and his unease with that is comic gold. And of course, I'll just mention, I'll be taking these Huggies and whatever cash you got. I mean, Raising Arizona, right. One of my all-time favorite comedies. Right. And again, just like in Vampire's Kiss, a different role, maybe not as gutsy, but highly stylized and just going for it.
Just going for it. And I remember reading an interview with Cher, actually, and she actually wanted to make sure that Nicolas Cage was in Moonstruck based on his performance in Peggy Sue Got Married, because she saw, like, she'd never seen anybody make such a bold decision with a character and just run with it and be successful.
Yeah, I love it.
My number three is Cary Grant as Walter Burns in His Girl Friday, one of my absolute favorites. And it's a performance you just don't see anymore, where somebody is so quick on his feet. And this film moves at a pace that's probably twice the speed of any film that is currently out in theaters. It's just a remarkable thing to watch. And between, you know, the relationship between he and Rosalind Russell, I mean, it's just complete magic. Mm-hmm. And it's a great performance.
It is. We love Cary Grant in a lot of different roles. Let's get on then to Dylan Kidd's number two.
Number two, Michael Keaton in Beetlejuice. I just, you know, when I was in high school, I saw this movie and just watched it over and over again. Yeah, just like the maniacal, over-the-top quality of it. Laugh out loud funny, amazing. I like performances that are right on the edge of being sort of like out of control. And Michael Keaton he's somebody who always, I think his career will always feel like the guy that somehow just like had more potential than, you know, Beetlejuice's example of like what this guy could really do if he was ever given the chance. I think he just came of age at a time when there were too many other like gifted comedic actors.
I love the nostalgia choices.
I do too.
I mean, you mentioned the kind of things that we heard come out of his mouth that were just like, those are Cinecast phrases.
Right.
You know, it's like, maybe he hasn't seen it in 20 years, but the memory of what Michael Keaton does in Beetlejuice is enough to get him on.
And you know, I seriously, on my short list, I had Michael Keaton in Mr. Mom, and I could go back to a ton of movies that I love Michael Keaton, and I think he makes a great point about how he really is a guy who, kind of like Nicolas Cage, does a lot of performances that are right on that edge
of being out of control.
But they don't get there. And I think he makes an interesting point too about that, maybe a guy who was underused had more potential and got wasted.
Well, I love one of our favorites, the sports guy, always talks about like he's waiting for some indie director to give, you know, Michael Keaton a chance like other, you know, underused performers have been. I'm still waiting for it too.
Yeah, kind of like a John Travolta Pulp Fiction kind of a coming out party.
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice to see. Number two, Sam, for me.
Yeah.
And it easily could have been my number one. Christopher Guest as Nigel Tufnel, and this is Spinal Tap. And I was thinking about the brilliance of it, other than the fact that every line that comes out of his mouth is hilarious. But there's, as we know with Christopher Guest, there's this comfort in the improvisation and just being in the moment, and that vacancy, being open to just being there and just letting it happen. And and Nigel's a guy who is vacant. I mean, he's pretty dumb, but yet so hilarious. And there's a line that I think makes it perfect where he says, I think we've maybe even referenced this on the show before, where he's talking to Rob Reiner, Marty DeBerge, and he talks about what he would be doing if he wasn't a rock star. And he says that he could be a shoe salesman. And you know, he says, I think we have that. Marty DeBerge says, yeah, you think you'd be happy doing something like, and Nigel cuts him off and says, no, we're all out. Do you wear black? See, that sort of thing I think I could probably muster up. There's that ability where Marty is trying to ask a question and go in a new direction, but Nigel, Christopher Guest, is still in the moment and just letting it come to him and continues to say what he wants to say.
There's
and
not
it's that
searching.
Funny.
I mean, like you said, he has the patience. I mean, it's just remarkable.
Yeah, that is it. There's this ease, like I said, in front of the camera where he's willing to just let it come to him.
Yeah, definitely made my short list, absolutely. But my number two is, and I think you look at a lot of this list, I mean, Adam Sandler being exception, but Gene Hackman, Cary Grant, obviously, both of those actors being good dramatic actors, equally good dramatic and comic actors. Here's another one, Jeff Bridges as the dude.
I knew it was Jeffrey coming.
Jeffrey Lebowski, how could it not be? And I really think this is a film, of course, I've studied in great detail by watching it, you know, God knows how many times, but this is a remarkable performance that I'm not sure quite I realized the achievement, you know, the first time. And I think because the whole character is built, and this is a credit to the Coen brothers as well, but this is a character who is in a kind of stasis. His whole life is in stasis. You know, it's about how do you make a character interesting that is really, you know, actively inactive.
Yeah.
Really. And it's only these certain passions that he has. Getting the Caucasian. You know, getting the ingredients for the Caucasian. Bowling. These certain things that keep enough momentum in his life. But there's so little else.
Yeah.
And yet it's just a remarkable performance. And so when his paradise is disrupted, it's like, it's, you know, it's catastrophic in some way.
Right, it is. It's an absolutely
brilliant
performance.
I
agree completely. And here is Dylan Kidd's number one male comedic performance.
And my number one male comedic performance of all time is Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein. This is, this is like an obvious suspect. But this is a movie that probably is the reason I went to film school. Like when I saw it when I was 7 or 8 and was just obsessed with it. And, you know, his ability to go the full arc of, you know, skeptic to, you know, devoted acolyte of his grandfather is just amazing. And for me, I think it has probably my favorite transition in cinema, which is when Gene Wilder insists that they not let him out. He's going to go into the room of the monster, and he's like, no matter how much I scream, do not let me out of this room, right? He goes his whole speech. So they lock him in, and he like takes one step forward and like rattles a chain, and the monster sits up, and Gene Wilder turns around and runs the door and says, let me out, let me the hell out of this room. And it just to this day, I laugh out loud when I see it.
I was sitting, you know, like I said, just a couple feet away from Dylan when he recorded that. And I could just all of a sudden picture the exact scene he's describing. And I was, of course, not wanting to get on mic, but I was bursting out laughing.
Yeah. Do not let me out of this room and then
Gene Wilder
let me out.
Is just a complete genius. And it's just like, it's, you know, he doesn't appear on my list, but it's like, I'm glad he's just being represented.
Exactly.
Here.
Yeah. He's not on my list either, and it pained me so much to leave him out for Willy Wonka. So what was your number one, Sam?
All right, my number one, this shouldn't be any surprise, because this is the first guess people have when they talk about like what would have been our Desert Island picks. It is, of course, Owen Wilson as Dignan in Bottle Rocket. Again, you want to talk about people batting 1,000, every single line that comes out of his mouth makes me laugh. And part of it is like knowing a character so well. You watch the movie, you have to know that things are asides, that certain things had to be improvised, you know, that were just coming out of Owen Wilson's mouth. And yet it's so in character. There's not a sense of him commenting on the situation outside of character. It's just, it's odd and quirky and yet so consistent. And it's just, it's a truly like, you feel like he was just so completely in the zone.
No, it is great. I agree with you completely. My number one is Kevin Klein in A Fish Called Wanda.
Oh, number
he won the
one.
Best
wow.
Supporting Actor Oscar for it, deservedly so. It's always fun, I think, watching really stupid people who think they're really smart, who just don't get it. And he's so unaware of everything around him. He's so inside his head. And the line at the end of the film when all the lines, when he's torturing Ken and eating his fish, that scene, partly obviously because of Michael Palin, but that entire sequence cracks me up. And, you know, I think Kevin Kline is a brilliant actor in general, whether he's playing comedic or dramatic performances. But when I thought about the ones that give me the most pleasure, that's the one that cracks me up from start to finish. There isn't, again, you're talking about batting a thousand, there isn't a bad moment that he has as Otto in A Fish Called Wanda. Let's briefly then play, and I mean briefly, here's Dylan Kidd's honorable mentions, some he couldn't avoid putting on his list. Here they are as honorable mentions.
And then two other performances under male comedic that I forgot to mention. I just think like Ted Knight and Caddyshack. I think it's one for the ages. Like, you think Caddyshack, oh, come on. It's not as, I mean, it's a, we all love it. It's a cult movie, but is that to be taken? Ted Knight and Caddyshack completely commits to that role. And I think he should have won an Oscar for that. It's nobody does the sort of, you know, righteous indignation better than Ted Knight. And I just would say for people to revisit that movie and really concentrate on just how much of a genius Ted Knight was. And I also just, I've always loved George C. Scott and Dr. Strangelove. I know that movie's all about Peter Sellers, but I just think, like, George C. Scott, you know, chewing gum maniacally in that war room and acting like a kid who's been caught, like, in the back room, you know, it's just, it's just genius.
Okay, I don't think you can argue with Ted Knight in Caddyshack or George C. Scott in Strangelove. Sure. I have a few honorable mentions as well. It was very hard. I mentioned leaving out Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka. Chevy Chase's Fletch, my all-time quotable movie. That's kind of a Pantheon performance I left out. Then a few definite honorable mentions. Steve Zahn in Out of Sight, Vince Vaughn in Swingers, Jack Black in High Fidelity, John C. Reilly is Reed Rothschild in Boogie Nights.
God, yes.
And also a movie, as our listeners know, I saw finally recently, Richard E. Grant in With Nail and I.
Really?
Is
wow.
That funny? Huh. He is.
Quickly, mine too. I've got Will Ferrell has to be represented in here. I'm giving it to him for Old School. Paul Giamatti and Sam Rockwell in Safe Men, an overlooked DVD pick of mine. Not long ago, Jason Schwartzman in Rushmore. Vince Vaughn, you said it, in Swingers, but also in Wedding Crashers, as bad as that film is. He's remarkable in it. Matt Dillon in Something About Mary. He's the best thing about that movie.
Yeah.
He's amazing. Christopher Guest and Michael McKean, both in This Is Spinal Tap. And because it doesn't belong anywhere else, Christopher Walken in True Romance.
Yeah.
You have to give credit to that performance.
It's such a small scene, but it's so good that you have to have it in there. I think
that's right.
A good point. And a quick clarification, Wedding Crashers, we did actually give a positive review to.
I'm sorry, it's not a bad film. It's just not a film we loved. But
as much
Vince
as
Vaughn,
most people did. And he is very good
in
at
the
it.
Zone. Talk about people in the zone.
Yeah, he is. So, okay, well, this segment is going long, but we're gonna keep going through, and we're going to get to our female comedic performances. Got the men out of the way. Now time for the women. Dylan Kidd, start it off.
Number five, Reese Witherspoon in Freeway. Which is a great, great early Reese Witherspoon, where she plays just insane, like trailer trash. Like, it's a retelling of the Little Red Riding Hood with Kiefer Sutherland as Jack Wolf, I think his name is. But it's proof that you know, whatever's going to happen to Reese Witherspoon, this movie is proof that she really, when given like the right material, is like, you know, she's incredible. And I would also put there's a whole separate category of performances, which are great actors willing mediocre material to a higher level. And I would say her in Legally Blonde is a good example of that. And Jim Carrey in Ace Ventura, just people who simply refuse to let the movie be mediocre. Like anybody else in Legally Blonde, and that, you know, that's like a, you know, Showtime up at, you know, Friday night movie. But she somehow wills it to a higher level.
Well, he's dead on. Reese Witherspoon is brilliant with the right material. What he says about Legally Blonde, I completely agree with. And Freeway, she is remarkable in it. So no arguing there. My number five, I'm going with maybe an odd choice a little bit, because I think of the movie somewhat as a drama, but Catherine Deneuve in Belle de Jour. Here you've got this comedy of manners from Buñuel. It's a satire. And she's so striking, as we've talked about. You see it in Repulsion, too, where she's an actress who's so aware of her sexuality, I think, the effect she has on men, but she never forces it. And watching her wade into these situations as the bourgeois wife in this movie who gets into prostitution, it's actually thrilling to watch someone discovering these parts of herself. And I don't think other actresses could completely pull it off. So
that's a good choice. And mine is Fei Wong as Fei in Chungking Express, Wong Kar-wai's film. Absolutely just a charming presence. I mean, we hear Dylan Kidd talk about this sense of just like who we like to watch on screen. Sometimes it's beautiful people being beautiful on a big screen. And with Fei Wong, it's like, it's the kind of stalker you could only dream of having. I mean, she's just weird and, you know, and weirdly conflicted and yet funny and charming to watch.
Yeah, I agree. Number four from Dylan Kidd. This may be, Sam, the single shining moment for me in the history of Cinecast, right here, Dylan Kidd's number four.
This in high school, this was a huge, you know, this is like one of the things that made me actually think differently about women and like sexuality is Kelly LeBrock in Weird Science, I think is just one of these great, I mean, it's like, you look at that movie and you're like, okay, you know, anybody could do that, but nobody could, you know, it's like when you watch Master and Commander and you're like, who else but Russell Crowe could have done that? Like, I challenge anybody to look at Weird Science and think of any other actress who looks like a model and has the comic chops who could pull this off, right? I mean, you can't. John Hughes was asking a lot. He needs this. He needs a bombshell who is also a Lucille Ball, and he gets it. Kelly LeBrock.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
what can you say but wow?
Let's talk about nostalgia.
Did you see that coming? No one did.
He threw on Kelly LeBrock from one of my all-time favorite movies, Weird Science. And I think he's right. Maybe I never really appreciated how good her comic timing is in that film.
It's time to go revisit.
Yeah, she
or
is really
Sam
good.
Walgren, it's time to go see.
It's a shame.
Weird Science.
It's just a total travesty that you managed to make it through junior high. Sam made it through puberty without seeing Kelly LeBrock.
You'd think I didn't
in
even
Weird
have
Science.
Any friends. I could go over to their house
it's
and
crazy.
Do a sleepover. And what was I doing?
I don't know what you were doing. My number four, Sam. Well, Nicolas Cage was on here for Raising Arizona. I've got Holly Hunter on here for Raising Arizona, and probably more so, actually, for Broadcast News. But in both roles, playing Jane Craig, the producer, or as Edwina, there's a ferociousness to both her roles. She's such a little bulldog, and yet she's got this incredible vulnerability, which I think makes her so fascinating to watch. And especially as Jane in Broadcast News, she's so high-strung, Sam. I mean, she makes type A personalities like me look like Prince Valium. Yeah. I mean, seriously, she's that high-strung. You should not like her, and yet she's always likable.
Yeah, that's a really good point. All right, well, my number four is one of my favorite actresses. It's Emma Thompson as Kate Lemon in The Tall Guy with Jeff Goldblum, which is a wonderful performance, but also as Beatrice in Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing. Two performances I love her in, but particularly with her performance as Kate Lemon in The Tall Guy, there's the pleasure of watching a great actress give a performance. She is playing a part, you know, and it's like, it's not just somebody relying necessarily, not that there's anything wrong with that, on natural charm. She is a gifted actress that is playing a comic performance that's kind of larger than life. In that case of The Tall Guy, it's somebody that's very stern, that doesn't suffer fools gladly, but she's got this weird, you know, sexual honesty about her too. It's a really hilarious movie, and she's wonderful in it as well. And of course, I just love Much Ado About Nothing as well. I mean, the banter between she and Kenneth Branagh is just like...
Emma is fantastic. I'm with you there. And let's go on now to Dylan Kidd's number three female comedic performance, which we like particularly, Sam, because this is a moment where someone as brilliant as Dylan Kidd gets to screw up just like we do every now and again. So there will be a quick Cinecast correction
immediately following this
choice. Here it is.
Number three, Barbara Stanwyck in All About Eve. Barbara Stanwyck is one of these great movie stars in that she's not particularly attractive, and yet she's so hot. It's unbelievable. I don't know what it is. It's like she just, it has nothing to do with like the way she looks. She just, you know, and everyone thinks of her in Double Indemnity, but there is an 8-minute uninterrupted take in the first act of All About Eve where she seduces, she contrives to get Henry Fonda back to her cabin on this boat, and she basically gets him all riled up before she kicks him out of the room. And it's the sexiest thing I've ever seen. It's like hilarious and sexy, and I love it.
Yes, that's all right. So before anyone calls the Cinecast hotline, yes, Dylan Kidd is talking about Lady Eve with Barbara Stanwyck.
Yeah.
The Lady Eve with Barbara Stanwyck, not All About Eve, which of course...
isn't really
Betty
a comedy.
Davis. Not a comedy
at
all.
Yeah, with Betty Davis
but
here,
But you can
got...
imagine the confusion, of course.
Absolutely. We will forgive him for it. We certainly make those mistakes too. He meant the Lady Eve, and I love what he said about Barbara Stanwyck
too,
because it's so true. Yeah. She is not particularly attractive, and yet
but
she
sexy,
is hot.
Yes.
There's just something incredible about her. You're number three then, Sam.
My number three, you just mentioned her, Holly Hunter, for me, as Jane Craig in Broadcast News. You're right. It's a fierce, emotional, she's so high-pitched, she's so high-strung, and like you said, yes, she should be unlikable, but you find her magnetic, and you understand why William Hurt and Albert Brooks both find her magnetic.
That's a great point. I didn't say that, but I had that in my notes about the performance, is she's so off-putting in some ways, and yet you understand why they're attracted to her.
You absolutely do.
You're attracted to that energy. My number three is Frances McDormand in Fargo. She won an Oscar for it, and I think the strength of it, obviously, is it's just such a brilliant character. You've got that the Coen brothers have created this very perceptive, competent sheriff. And being a woman and 7 months pregnant, she defies our expectations. And I think she does give a real heart to the film. As I told you, I think that some people can watch it and think she's parodying or making fun of a Minnesotan. And yet I don't really think she ever does that throughout the film. I don't think she ever makes us laugh at her. I think we're laughing with her when she says, like, I think I'm going to barf. you know, we understand it because we understand what she's going through. I mean, we think it's funny, but again, we're laughing at her situation, not at her as a female sheriff, I don't think. So anyway, I love her performance, and it's my number three. And that brings us then to Dylan Kidd's number two.
Obvious number two, Diane Keaton and Annie Hall. I will say, I just watched Sleeper recently, and I've never been more attracted to Diane Keaton. I think like she was actually shooting Godfather 1 and Sleeper at the same time. But Annie Hall, obviously incredible. The whole thing where she first brings Woody Allen back to her apartment, and she tells the story, and she's sort of like la-di-da. I mean, it's just, that's great. And anything she does, I love. Manhattan Murder Mystery. I mean, she's great and continues to be great.
Another Oscar-winning performance.
That's true.
Diane Keaton and Annie Hall.
A
tough omission, and really, for me too, I love how he mentions, because I love Diane Keaton. She's just not going to appear on my list, but she's just an actress I absolutely love, and I considered her for Manhattan Murder Mystery. I think she's just really wonderful, and here's somebody that maybe is, and relying sounds negative, but just on her charm as an actress, just her screen persona, and it's what makes her so watchable in Annie Hall, but also in Manhattan Murder Mystery and Sleeper and any number of other Woody Allen movies and others. So let's get to my number two, and it is Ruth Gordon in as Maude in Harold and Maude. I think, like Harold, you can't help but be enraptured by Ruth Gordon in this film. It's like she's got such a light touch in her depiction of a truly, truly eccentric person. And there's just no question watching the film that that's how the character behaves. There's no sense of her performing the role of an eccentric, and it's just you fall in love with her just as Harold does. Mm-hmm. And it's just a remarkable achievement, you know, on the film's part.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. She was actually on my list at one point, yeah, and then got bumped out by somebody, but she is really good in it. So my number two then, Nicole Kidman in To Die For. It's nice to live in a country where life, liberty, and all the rest of it still stand for something, she says. And the beauty of that, the way she delivers that line and the entire role, I think, is that she has absolutely no sense of irony. She's never winking
right,
at you.
Right.
She's never judging her character. She absolutely embraces Suzanne Stone's ambition, her drive to succeed and to be famous. And I think that it's an amazing performance from Nicole Kidman, an overlooked performance in that she got shunned from the Oscars. She should have got a nomination, probably. Number one, we're finally here, Sam, at our number one. Here is Dylan Kidd's number one female comedic performance.
And the number one of all time for me, female comedic performance, is Carol Lombard in My Man Godfrey, which is my all-time favorite screwball comedy. And it's just like the abandon with which Carol Lombard takes on the spoiled rich girl is just unbelievable. I mean, just like, you know, jumping on the bed and demanding that Godfrey love her. It's completely surreal, that movie. And that's one of those great old movies that you sort of take for granted. And then when you watch it, you're like, this is a really, like, effed up movie. This is, like, really kind of over the edge. And, you know, Carol Lombard died tragically young. But this is a great, again, it's just joyous. I just smile. When I watch that movie, I just can't take my eyes off her. And everything that comes out of her mouth just makes me smile.
So a film I think, Adam, we neither of us have seen, but which will appear, actually,
in our screwballs,
on our Screwball Comedy Marathon, which will follow our Herzog Kinski Marathon.
That's right. We're going to include it. We're not sure what we're going to dump out yet, but it will replace something, because if Dylan's willing to bring it up as his number one comedic performance from a woman, then we're going to put it on there. My number one, Sam, is one that we actually talked a little bit about last night on the phone, and that is Giulietta Messina, Fellini's wife in Fellini's Knights of Cabiria. I think in a role that's really a precursor in many ways to what we saw from Audrey Tautou in Amelie, that same kind of weird charisma and just lust for life in a way, and just happiness. And you said, you know, this movie is not a drama, or this movie is not a comedy. It's a drama. It's heartbreaking. It's about betrayal. And that's all true. And yet what I told you, I think, is right, I hope, is that you saw it more recently than I have.
I did.
I saw it several years ago, and I love it. And I've seen it more than once, but all I remember from it is that bliss, is the comedy she brings to a movie that is about. I mean, I think that has to be the brilliance of the performance, is I know it's about betrayal and heartbreak, and the end is heartbreaking, and yet there's something
and
about her performance.
And it's somebody who's even jaded in some way, and yet there's an essence to her.
Yeah, and yet there's something about her happiness with life and her willing to move on with things. I remember her happiness, and so with that in mind, and the humor of it, she's very funny.
Of course, yeah.
And so it's my number one.
It's an amazing movie. I did see it recently. It is just a phenomenal movie. I mean, when you see the innocence of her, like, on stage when she has to, or when the magician has her reenact like this love scene, it's just an amazing, amazing film. And like the film almost overwhelms her performance. It's a work of absolute genius. My number one, I mentioned Cary Grant in His Girl Friday. My number one comic performance is Rosalind Russell as Hildy Johnson in His Girl Friday. There, you know, without Cary Grant, there's no Rosalind Russell, and without Rosalind Russell, there's no Cary Grant. This film requires both of them, and it is a pair of comic performances that have almost no peer. It is just a remarkable, remarkable movie because of these two performances.
Yeah, and let's get on then. Dylan Kidd's honorable mentions. Here they are.
I had to mention Catherine O'Hara in Beetlejuice because I think it's a great over-the-top. I just love Catherine O'Hara, and that's one of those movies back in her prime where she really got to go there and sort of holds her own with Michael Keaton. And then Maggie Smith in Gosford Park is a great example of, like, I think of Maggie Smith in Gosford Park as like Steve Zahn and Out of Sight. Like, she only has like 12 lines, but each line makes you laugh out loud. You know, there's a great moment early in the movie where, like, I can't remember the guy's name. Bob Balaban like pulls over the side of her coach is broken down or something, and he says, "Are you okay?" And she looks at him and goes, "Okay?" Like, she doesn't even know what that is. And it's just like nobody drips disdain like Maggie Smith. She's great.
I know you love this, Sam, the Maggie Smith reference.
I was pumping my fist. I was like, yes. I mean, really, it
was
is.
Was that distracting for him?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Probably.
Yeah. I think he nearly walked out of the room.
Well, but my honorable mentions, I mentioned Audrey Tautou. I do love her performance in Amelie. Mm. I have Rosalind Russell from His Girl Friday on my honorable mention, Diane Keaton from Annie Hall, and Reese Witherspoon in Election.
Yeah, sure. I've got Reese Witherspoon in Election as well. Also, Diane Wiest in Bullets Over Broadway, T. Leone in Flirting with Disaster. I've got, you mentioned her, Nicole Kidman as Suzanne Stone in To Die For, Cher and Moonstruck, and Anne Bancroft in The Graduate, the great late Anne Bancroft.
Okay, great choices there. We're going to take one more short break. When we come back, Dylan, Sam, and I eschew the laughs and embrace the tears. Our top five male and female dramatic performances are next. But first, here's Scott Ferguson again, and we should mention that Scott's last list, Sam, you had to love. I know I did, seeing Liza Minnelli for Cabaret on his list.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Of favorite female performances. Also, Shirley MacLaine in The Apartment almost made my comedic, and Jane Fonda include another
Boy,
favorite of yours.
We may see her, yes,
may
indeed.
See her yet again here as we get into the next segment. But let's go ahead and hear now, going into the break, Scott Ferguson's top five male modern performances.
Number five, Jack Lemmon in The Apartment. Maybe toward the end of the studio era, but what a performance. Gene Hackman, The French Connection, number four. Number three, Robert De Niro in Raging Bull. Gotta be on the list. Number two, Paul Newman in HUD. And number one, Jack Nicholson. And I just couldn't pick one. I am picking the grand slam of roles from the early 70s, including Carnal Knowledge, The Last Detail, Five Easy Pieces, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in Chinatown. What a stretch of work.